Blog Talk Radio.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, pick it black and pick it fast. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
And sometimes I wait till he says right on a couple of times, so it brings back the old days.
You know, yeah,
welcome
it does.
To American Heart of Darkness Blog Talk Radio. This is Bob Kirkconnell, your host. And we have the pleasure today of having Fulton Arrington on. And he is, when I ran into him, he reviewed my book for a newspaper that I think it's the Sovereign Mixblood is a newspaper that you're the editor for. Is that right, Fulton?
Yes. It's not exactly a paper. It's online. But it is a source for,
it's a paper.
You know, I like to think of it as an intellectual native news source.
Yeah. And he was good enough to do a critical review of my book, and I passed the test, and he gave me a thumbs up, and I was really glad about that. But Fulton is aware of, and he knows quite a bit about Native American issues and the history of what happened to Native Americans in this country, and a lot about what's going on now. A lot of people think all this was over with. But, you know, there's still land being stolen. There's still land being poisoned. There's still timber being cut, resources taken out, pollution left behind, all these things that are happening on reservations. And you can look at it as an assault on the culture. And today. And so we're really happy to have Fulton on, and you know, we're going to look into some past issues and contemporary issues, but mostly we're going to leave it pretty wide open. I encourage everybody to call in. Well, not everybody at the same time, but the guest call in is 347-202-0257, and you know, I'm sure we can, you know, if you got a question, we'll just stop talking because we've got plenty of time and listen to your question. And Fulton will do his best to illuminate the issues. And Fulton, you know, first of all, thank you so much for what you've done for me. And I especially want to thank you for keeping some of these issues alive and documenting what's going on. With my audiences, I tell them, you know, and this goes back to Dick Gregory, who was, of course, he was African American. He was first a comedian, but then he was a an activist.
And he was also a very deep thinker.
Oh, he was. He had a profound, you know, after Kent State, and all the these white kids that got shot on campus by the National Guard over the Vietnam protest. And he brought up a real good point, and you know, I'd like you to expand on it some. You know, he said what America does to minorities, it eventually does to whites. And he said,
yes, that's correct.
Blacks always. Coming for you. And those weren't his exact words, but I'm sure that, you know, you could probably draw some analogies or discuss what has been done to Native Americans and what has been done to others and what is happening in this country right now.
Yes, well, first I want to say it's good to be here, and, thank you for your time. But more importantly, I want to express my appreciation for the work you did in American Heart of Darkness. It was a wonderful book, and although the subject matter is rather dark, I did find it quite inspiring, and I just want to say I appreciate that. Having said that, first off, a lot of times I think, you know, and just kind of set a preamble, if you will. When we compartmentalize the human family into different groups, you know, we do that because it's sort of a community thing and it's part of how we live. But you're right. What happens to minorities is eventually going to happen to everybody else. You know, people permit injustice to take place because they say, well, that will never happen to me. And, you know, the position, my position, and although I am a mixed-blood Native American, and I'm very proud of that, and my primary interest is toward my people and my community, but at the same time, you know, I heard somebody quote a rhyme once, and I don't know if the story is correct or maybe just apocryphal, but it's from the early days of Nazi Germany. And they said, well, you know, when they came for the Jews, I did not speak. I was not Jewish. When they came for the gypsies, I spoke not. I was not gypsy. When they came for the gays, I did not speak. I was not gay. When they came for me, there was no one left to speak.
Yeah.
And I think when we see things taking place that, affect people negatively, or we see injustice perpetrated, I think it was Benjamin Franklin that once said, justice will not prevail until the ones who are not affected are outraged. And that's something that, you know, we need to remember as we walk through life, not just from a standpoint of, well, you know, this is my issue and this is what I care about. You know, if you're walking down the street and, you know, a child is drowning, the mother of that child is not going to look at what color you are before she says, bring my child back to me.
Right.
And, I think from a standpoint of conscience and honor, if you will, that, you know, we need to have that in the forefront of our minds. You know, if lynch law is being perpetrated somewhere else, it is my problem because I could be next. You know, I went to many years ago, I went to a protest over a person that had been fired from a certain company because they were gay. And my wife at the time was somewhat upset because I went down there, and at that time there was a rather militant outfit called Queer Nation they were heading up the protest, and I went down there, and we went out to dinner afterwards, and I was still wearing a Queer Nation T-shirt. She says, everybody's going to think you're gay. And I said, well, you know, that is not necessarily a bad thing. Maybe it will start a conversation because, again, when they came for me, there was no one left to speak. And, you know, so many times the people will ask when you show up to get involved in something, and they'll say, why do you care about this? You're not fill in the blank. And, you know, that it again comes down to the same point of when they came for me, there was no one left to speak. And so we have to honor our conscience first and foremost. And when enough of us start doing that, then I think the world will be a better place. You know, granted, it won't be perfect, but it'll be better.
I think it'd be a lot better. That's been the strategy is to, in my take, is to divide the American people into black, white, brown, Native American, and all of these things. It's like these people are other people and not us.
Uh-huh.
When really we're all of the same. Some of the genealogy that I did, you know, I found out that there were all kinds of, there were tens of thousands of gypsies that came to this country. There were all sorts of Berbers that were out of Spain with the Spanish Inquisition. The Berbers, the Moors, enlisted troops, and they fled along with the Jews, and a lot of them went into Germany and came to this country as what we now call Pennsylvania Dutch, which was far from Dutch. And,
yes, yeah, that was a euphemism to avoid being categorized in a, shall we say, less favorable racial category, if you will.
You were white in those days, and you had all sorts of people that came in here and even changed their names. The Berber name, Haile ended up to be Hale and Hall. And now we have people that have completely forgotten this because these people, I have relatives have been hiding their heritage for so long that they have forgotten why they're hiding it, but they're still doing it. They have the tradition of hiding who they are, and they've forgotten who they are. And
it becomes a part of the DNA. When there's a great deal in that, there's a word for it in certain psychology circles today. It's called generational trauma. And people will when an organism experiences mortal fear. And I mean absolute mortal fear. The survival of the species dictates survival, obviously. And so when an organism experiences just really catastrophic mortal fear, it creates a certain what you might call a multi-generational trauma, so to speak. And people will, you know, even today, you know, I talk to Native people who are maybe living off the reservation or are living in the mainstream society, and they won't talk about their history except in very close groups because they don't know why. I talked to a man, and this has been about 10 years ago, and I talked to a man, and he had Cherokee ancestry, and I asked him, I said, well, why don't you celebrate that? And he said, oh, I can't. It's against the law. I said, no, it isn't. Oh, yes, it is. I was taught we didn't get into that. Now, and then when I went and researched, you know, laws that had been on the books in places, I mean, there was a time when saying that could get you in legal issues depending on your circumstance. But that fear, that palpable fear was still there. It was in his bones. And it actually took, now today, you know, he celebrates his heritage, but it took about 5 or 6 years for him to come out of the closet, so to speak, and really celebrate his heritage. And there really was that palpable fear still there, and that's a multi-generational thing because in his lifetime, you know, that it had never been the case where, you know, he had never experienced discrimination, but it was hardwired into his nervous system, so to speak. And you know, I started out, I'm a minister now, but I started out as a militant. And that was a lot of fun. You know, I enjoyed being a militant. I enjoyed protesting. I enjoyed walking around with big knives and a bad attitude. And until I came to realize that I wasn't doing anything useful with that because, yeah, you can go in and maybe solve a problem, maybe defend somebody who doesn't have anybody else to defend them, but when you leave, they're still where they were. You know, you have to shift the paradigm. Solving the problem, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you go to the doctor and he treats the symptom, but he doesn't cure the disease. And, you know, if you're going to do anything useful in this dispensation, this mortal life that we live, we have a limited amount of time, and it calls for a shifting of the paradigm to a more positive and productive approach. I mean, it's fine to blame people or to say it's all somebody else's fault or whatever, but we actually have to, as human beings, approach it and say we're going to do something useful. We're going to commit a revolutionary act by making something better and doing it in a positive way. You know, that's I think that's what made Dr. King's nonviolence so effective, is that you cannot fight evil by becoming evil.
Yeah, there's you probably saw it in my book that and I really thought it was it's irony, but be careful who you choose as enemies, because you will become like them.
Mm-hmm. And that is so true. That is so true. And that's what I think, in a sense, you know, the old saying goes that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And, you know, as you and I were speaking the other day about Suetonius and the 12 Caesars and the speeches made by Caesars in Rome in the imperial era sound so much like speeches made by modern politicians today, it's kind of scary that we haven't learned any more than that in, 2,000 years?
Yeah, I think you said it was the same words.
Some of them were. I mean, I literally could cut and paste. And that was like, oh Lord, you know, this is that's really, it's sad in one sense, but you know, as I've said before, I'm an optimist. I believe that as long as they're, you know, it's sort of my favorite analogy is the 10 righteous in Sodom. As long as there are 10 righteous, there's hope for the world, so to speak. And by righteous, I don't mean religious. I mean righteous in the sense of a commitment to trying to alter your world for the better.
Yeah, for some reason it's clicking in me that, I also have Highlander Scott ancestry, and
uh-huh.
You know, it always seemed ironic to me that the British went up there and just wiped out the Highlands. I mean, there were people that said you couldn't see anything alive, or you could walk all day and not see a live human being. And depopulated the Highlands. And then they turn around and they have these Highland regiments in the British Army. And we, this country, when I say we, this country annihilated the Native Americans, and then, you know, we've got the Milwaukee Braves, and we've got, and then we turn around and idolize people that we want to get rid of, and it just.
Well, that's part of the politics of power, you know. I mean, and it's there's a big controversy about that, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, you may have heard recently. There's been a dust up about the Washington Redskins. And it's been, you know, an issue, and I think to some extent, you know, a lot of our people are really concerned about it, because as they say, you couldn't have, you couldn't have the Washington Whiteskins, for instance, somebody would get offended, or the New York Jews or something like that, because, you know, these communities would rise up. And rightly so. You know, I think if somebody proposed the concept of a baseball team in Brooklyn called the East Side Heimies, there would be a great outrage, and there should be. One of the biggest problems that Native Americans have is that we're not sufficiently united to be able to bring that kind of political pressure to bear, because we think of ourselves in terms of our tribe, our nation first, and as Native Americans only after. And even to some extent, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the disenrollment issue that's going on the West Coast right now. But there are a number of federally recognized tribes out there that are disenrolling people en masse. And, you know, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, I believe it is, are the latest addition to this rather disgraceful story. And they're disenrolling a family of people that are descended from one of their first chiefs. And, you know, this is a case of a minority community becoming, copying the worst aspects of the dominant culture, you know, where greed trumps honor and where expediency trumps loyalty. And again, you know, we can look at that in two ways. From one standpoint, we can look at it and say, well, you know, these people are greedy idiots. And that's the headline, if you will. But if you consider from a philosophical standpoint, how did we arrive at this point? And we arrive at this point because, in some sense, we cede our sovereignty. In other words, you know, you see tribal communities and they're trying to get recognized, which means that your identity isn't yours. It's something that is given to you by the government. And once you cede that sovereignty, if it's something the government gives, then the government can take it away.
Yes.
You know, I'm an American Indian. I am a Cherokee man, not because I am enrolled in any one of the federal Cherokee tribes, but because that is my birthright. That
right.
is my family. That's how I was brought up. That is my identity. And that's not something that a piece of paper can either give me or take away from me. But a lot of our people have, you know, because that's the nature of things, they have allowed themselves to, they've surrendered their sovereignty, so to speak, to the government, to the colonial power. And so, and what Rome gives, Rome can take. And, you know, your loyalty, your soul is between you and your creator. It's not something that any government, any group of men can give to you or take away from you. And when you cede that birthright to another power, another entity, be it a government, you know, a club or whatever, once you cede it, once you say you have that power, then they can give it to you or they can take it away from you. And
right.
it pollutes your birthright, so to speak. Your birthright must be yours, and it must be something that you're prepared to defend. You know, we have a saying among mixed bloods in our congregation here is, you know, I will stand before my Creator with my honor and my birthright intact, and I will cede it to no man. And, you know, that gives you, my father used to tell me, and my father was a man whose intellect I respect just about above all else. He was a tremendous thinker. And he used to tell me that when you look in the mirror and you pray to your Creator, your God, however you understand that, that has to be, that is sacred. That is something you cede to no one. Because the minute you do, you become weak. And that weakness allows you to be manipulated by powers that don't have your best interest at heart. And so here we have these tribes who, you know, they have casino money or they have, you know, they have housing contracts or whatever, and the fewer people on the rolls, the more money there is to go around. Well, that money is temporary. You know, these tribal nations have histories that are sometimes 8,000-10,000 years old, and yet they're losing that vision in pursuit of a fiat currency that in 500 years will be forgotten. You know, so,
yeah, I think,
you know, we have to consider our honor and our birthright in terms of meta time, if you will. Not in terms of temporary expediency. And when we cede the sovereignty of our souls to temporary expediency, we take something away from ourselves.
Yeah, I had high school students that, I noticed this in our history books, that there wasn't really a whole lot about the Declaration of Independence. And it was like it was hidden. I mean, it was there, but it was attachment 32 or something like that. Not much.
A beautiful document, by the way.
Oh, no question about it. I have my criticisms of some of the framers, but I will say that that Jefferson is considered the author of that. And I seem to recall in there that he said that we are endowed by our Creator with inalienable
with
rights.
Certain inalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yes, and that was a key phrase in there, that a government does not give you your rights. Your Creator gave them to you. And since
Amen.
The government did not give them to you, they can't take them away. And a lot
exactly.
of Americans have... that I used to tell my students that, and they'd say, well, they can come and arrest you and they can do this. And I'd say, well, there's consequences, there's consequences, but don't ever give that away. And if everybody knew that and did that, this was Gandhi's thing. They can't arrest all of us.
And if they do, they have to beat us.
Yeah. And Martin Luther King also, had that same concept that, these people only have the power that we let them have. And
absolutely.
The power is always with the people unless we cede it to those that we think. And we give it to them and then complain about it.
That is, for me personally, is a frustrating thing. People vote their vice and then complain that their leaders don't appeal to their virtue. There's a story I'll tell you about something that happened in the South after the war between the states, and it's very fascinating. There was a case, because the Republicans at the time was not the Republican Party of today, but that's another discussion that I'll skirt around. But the Republicans and the Democrats, and Democrats at that time were the party of the Old South, and the Republicans figured they were going to win. And I forgive me, but I can't remember what district it was in, but I do remember reading the story, and the thing that stuck with me, and it's been several years, that's why I can't remember all of it, but the thing that struck me is they were going to put in a sewer line. And the poor whites, who actually had more in common with the Republicans than they did with the Democrats, because at that time the Democratic Party in the South represented the planter class. And the poor whites, they were going to get indoor plumbing for the first time since ever. The problem was that the Republicans insisted on extending it out to the black community, and that meant that black men could defecate in the same sewer system that white men did. And so what the Democrats did is they convinced the poor whites in that district that it would be somehow impure for black men to defecate in the same sewer system. And so they were able to win the election and not put in the sewer system. And that's the appeal to prejudice that I see to a certain extent taking place in modern politics, and I'm not taking either side in the as far as the parties go. I'm just pointing out a neutral fact that when a political class figures out how to get elected without having to deliver anything to their constituents, then the constituents need to look at themselves and look at why they're voting for who they're voting for rather than complain about it. Because the bumper sticker that says if the people lead, the leaders will follow is very true. If you don't vote for them, they don't get elected. and that's a fact. But if we elect leaders because they appeal to our vices, we shouldn't our baser instincts, we shouldn't criticize them when they don't inspire us after they get in office.
You got what you voted for.
Exactly. You know, you voted for me because I told you I was a bigger butt than the next guy, and now you complain that I'm not a deep-thinking leader. Well, if I had been a deep-thinking leader, you wouldn't have elected me. So there you go. I mean, you know, we get the government we deserve. It's like that old Aesop's fable about the crow and the pigeons. And he convinces the pigeons to elect him king because he can't hunt them. They always, you know, he tries to hunt them, and one of them's always standing out a sentry, and he warns the rest of them off, and so he never can get a meal. So finally he gets up in this dead tree, and he says, well, you know, if you elected me your king, you wouldn't have to have one of your people always out watching, you know. I would protect you. And so they said, hey, that's a great idea. So they elect him king, and then he announces that, you know, a pigeon has to be sacrificed for his dinner every night. And the moral to the story being those who put themselves under the power of a tyrant deserve what fate they receive. And this, in a sense, is the dumbing down of the American population. You know, we want our kids to learn math and science because that will make them good gears for the machine. But only the ruling class kids get to go to liberal arts colleges where they learn how to think. And, you know, we must, as citizens, not as citizens of the United States or Russia or Venezuela or Mexico or wherever, we must defend our birthright. And one of our birthrights as created beings is the right to think and the right to learn how to think. And that's not a native thing or a white thing or a black thing. That is a human thing. And if we don't defend our right to think, we will elect a ruling class that will take it away from us.
It reminds me of, again, some of my high school students, and actually when I do book launches and book signings and things, and we've got this paradigm, these glasses that we put on and look through, that only look at things a certain way, like, and people will make jokes about, well, lesser of two evils, Democrat, Republican, and Tweedledum and Tweedledumber and all these things. But what I found out is that America has forgotten that it has been third parties that have been responsible for most of the socialization legislation that has gone, including Social Security. That came from the
populist. Yeah, that's because they altered the paradigm.
Yeah, and we have this view today that you're throwing your vote away unless you vote for a Democrat or Republican, when it's actually change comes from third parties. If they can pull enough votes where neither party can get a majority of the electorate, that even if they don't win an election, one or two of those parties has to play to them on their agenda, and they get their agenda in there whether they won the election or not. And that happened over and over.
But see, the problem with the throwing your vote away thing is we allow a philosophical decision to be reduced to the intellectual level of a ball game. And don't get me wrong, I like to play ball. But it's not about winning or losing. It's about doing what you believe is right. Now, you know, you can be sincerely wrong. But if you believe it's right and you stick to it, at least you have the honor of being able to say, I did what I believed was right. Instead of saying, well, you know, one guy said strychnine, and the other guy said rat poisoning, and rat poisoning kills slower, so I opted for the rat poisoning. No, just don't drink the Kool-Aid. You know, I mean, do what you know is right because it's right, not necessarily because it's going to win. Because if you allow your philosophy to be dictated by winning and losing, you miss the point.
Yeah, it has, and there have been some things in America that have just recently, and I think it really strikes back at why we haven't really made too much progress. in social issues. And one of them is, if you're a third-party candidate and you're a real threat, sometimes you end up with some health problems in this country. You know, there was, let's say, George Wallace and Ross
Bobby
Perot
Kennedy?
Ended up.
Jack Kennedy?
Yeah.
Let's see. Which I don't know whatever happened to Ralph Nader. And of course, there was our old friend Ross Perot, which incidentally I'm very glad he didn't get elected president.
I'm sure, you know, George Wallace. But here's the thing, you know, I didn't agree with him, but he had a right to run, and people had a right to vote for him. And he didn't deserve to get shot because he was exercising his constitutional right as a citizen. I don't agree with, you know, incidentally, he put on a lot of that bluster to get elected, but actually...
He did. I mean, Wallace philosophically was not in his early life, and I lived in Alabama during his last governorship, and I knew him. I didn't know him personally. I mean, we didn't swap spit in the shower, but, you know, I did know him, and I had seen him a time or two. But in his early days, he wasn't philosophically what he became. You know, and
right.
This is where, and, you know, I am reluctant to criticize people who are no longer with us because I think it's, you know, it's very easy for hindsight's 2020. It's very easy for us to sit back and criticize this person or that person and say, "Well, I would have done it differently." But if we weren't there, we don't know what we would have done. But having said that, Wallace is a classic example of he was what you might call a progressive. I mean, he believed that he could do some good for his constituents. And that was, in the early days, what motivated him to run for public office. But somewhere along the line, he sort of made the deal because in order to get elected, he had to sell out what he personally believed for what the mob dictated. And we see that today. I mean, we see politicians running for office, and, you know, they're positioning themselves for a primary challenge because, you know, they're afraid somebody's going to beat them, and they're so concerned about keeping their job, they're not worried about leading. And we, as the voting public, we exacerbate that because, you know, we swallow what's given to us in the Citizens United commercials, and we don't think. And, you know, and that's our fault. You know, I'm not here to criticize leaders at all for doing what the people tell them to do. But I do think that when we go into the voting booth, we owe it to ourselves. We owe it to our sovereignty, our sense of sovereign honor, if that's a kind of a forgotten concept today. But, you know, we owe that to ourselves to make that decision based on what we believe is right, not based on who is going to be the most strident jackass in the race. You know, horse racing is horse racing, and politics is politics, and leadership is leadership. And my personal belief, and when I go to vote, and I vote faithfully and consistently, even if there's nobody there I really want to vote for, I'll write somebody in because I'm exercising a right. And incidentally, I'm exercising a right that was denied to my community until, what, 1924?
Yeah.
So, you know, I when I go to vote, I remember the ancestors in my family who couldn't vote, 100 years or so ago. And so that's why I vote, even though I'm often disgusted with the collection. And sometimes I'll just write in a candidate that I know doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning, but at least I've made that effort. And, you know, that's the point of, you know, you will not long be sovereign if you do not exercise sovereignty. And if when we don't exercise that sovereignty, when we allow the game to be pitched to us as you can have this or you can have that, no, challenge the paradigm. And winning or losing, that's not the point. The point is exercising your sovereignty by doing what you believe is right. You know, for example, the defense at Nuremberg for most of the Nazi officers that were put on trial there was, I was just following orders. And the international community said that that is not a defense. That is not a defense against crimes against humanity. So therefore, if you are being commanded to do something that you know in your heart is wrong, then you must stand up or you must surrender your honor, one or the other.
Yeah, with those Nazis, there was a guy, and he ended up being in the CIA, and actually he ended up on the Warren Commission, and his name was McCloy, and I think he was he was in Germany. He was actually in charge of Germany. They called him the Magistrate Germany or a term like that. And he pardoned and commuted the sentence of the vast majority of those Nazis that were convicted. There were only a few of them, huh? Like about six or something like that.
Yeah, very few.
Yeah,
and a few of them died in prison.
And, and a lot of them that he pardoned ended up, Klaus Barbie ended up in South America and was instrumental in creating the whole drug trade that we're dealing with now. That was Klaus Barbie. And there were, over and over again, you see these people that McCloy pardoned, and I'm sure he didn't do that on his own. It was the CIA took him into the United States, and they took him into South America.
Yeah, because they were useful. Useful. And that's the key. When you can't make a deal with the devil and not get dirty. And this is where I remember I had a very heated conversation back some time ago with a gentleman. It was right after the 9/11 incident, and he said, you know, if torture works, then we should use torture. And I said, well, the problem with that is the United States has set itself up in the post World War II era as a paragon of human rights virtue. Now, whether or not that's true is beside the point, but that was the image. So if we, and I say we in a macro sense, if we turn around and do what we've criticized, you know, I think both of us grew up in a Cold War era when it was, you know, it was us and them. It was the free world and the not free world. And you know, the whole point of human rights and so on and so forth was to draw a very stark contrast between the free world and the world behind the Iron Curtain. And if we turn around and we start justifying our enemies by using their same methods, then we lose something. We lose a moral imperative. And when we do that, you know, we don't bring them up, we bring ourselves down.
Yeah, it's happened over and over again that this whole waterboarding thing. You know, what are we doing
and
now?
Well, the danger is, and you know, these are things. And even as a Native American, I have to say I admire some of the great Enlightenment thinkers of Europe. You know, Voltaire and Jefferson, even though he may have been a man of many vices in his personal life, was a very enlightened thinker. You know, he wished, he wanted to be better than he was. And that's the thing that makes him a great leader, is he desired to be better, and he desired to leave a world better than he found it. Now, he was not necessarily a particularly good person as far as Native Americans were concerned, but he was a good man insofar as he understood that. And I think the part of the problem that we get into, particularly when we get into racial politics and identity politics, and Native Americans, by the way, live with identity politics every day, because so much of our identity is imposed upon us by external forces, and if we don't actively resist that, it's very easy to succumb. But having said that, the problem that we get into with identity politics is, well, you know, that's a black issue, or, you know, that's a Native American issue, or that's a white issue, or whatever. And we don't consider the fact that at the end of the day, all of us are going to have to live here, you know, and we're going to have to live together, and we have to find some balance and harmony in that. And if our interests are diametrically opposed, and if we buy that paradigm, then that means I don't vote for a white politician regardless of whether he's decent or not. Well, I got news for you. Just because you're Native doesn't mean you're a good person. Although we'd like to believe that. It's not true. And so, you know, in the world that we live in today, you know, I live in a house, I have central heat and air, and I happen to like that. You know, I don't want to go back to the stone axe. And so, you know, we have to reach a point where we can live with ourselves and live with each other. And as we see this sort of new tribalism taking place where the, you know, the one guy says, well, I don't want to have a path to citizenship because all those people will vote Democrat. Well, I got news for you. They won't necessarily. You know, I mean, there's probably a lot of Democratic politicians that are going to find themselves voted out by people they got citizenship for. That's the nature of politics. But, you know, if we buy that paradigm, then we don't talk to each other, we don't get ideas from each other, and we don't progress together. And if we don't progress, we regress, and we end up going backwards. And that's not good for any of us. You know, it's a funny thing that, you know, well, today, you know, in Gandhi's time, India was a British colony. And, you know, they were subject to British rule. And Gandhi stood up and said, they can't lock up all of us, and if they do, they have to feed us, so we're going to go collect salt.
Yeah.
And that's a simple thing, but he was exercising his birthright. It was his land. It was his salt, so to speak. So he was going to get it. Now we see the heirs of Gandhi, and the bad part is Gandhi was killed by one of his own people because he was a little too fair or a little too holy or a little too idealistic. So that's something to remember. You know, if you're going to be a leader like that, you may get shot in the back. But, you know, having said that, if we look at now and today, Silicon Valley is almost an Indian colony. You know, there's not a tech startup around today that doesn't have at least one Indian founder. And I don't mean Native American. I mean Indian from India.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have propelled the Internet world and the Internet economy forward light years from probably what it would have been without their influence. And we, you know, and including people from Britain, are now reaping the benefits of that, you know, that they can move money around the world with Indian technology. So you see how, you know, if you want to call it karma, if you want to call it the natural order of things, you see how that progresses. But if they were to say, you know what, I'm not going to the United States or I'm not going to Britain because of this or that or the other, then that wouldn't be happening. So at some point you have to put aside prejudice simply to progress. And we all have our prejudices. I'm not saying that we should be without prejudice, because that's not going to happen. We all have our prejudices, but we have to recognize that as a vice like any other and regulate it as such.
Yeah, for some reason what you're saying there reminds me of my high school class. Yeah, a great deal of them, the males anyway. There might have been some females, I don't know, but the males, a lot of us ended up in Vietnam. And,
right.
And one of the guys, and I'll just call him Bob because he's still around, but he was in country, and he's full of Agent Orange, and he's lost all his fingers except for his thumbs. I still talk with him on the internet and things like that, and he types with his thumbs, and And Bob was, he put something on there about immigrants, illegal immigrants, undocumented, you know, coming into the country. And I got a chance to talk with him extensively about that. I've got Agent Orange in me too. And I, you know, I told him, I said, Bob, I want you to think about something. You know, we have people that run this country that dumped Agent Orange on us. And look what it did to us. But you know, a lot of those immigrants that come into this country that are undocumented or whatever, a lot of them are farmers that under the guise of spraying for the drugs, war on drugs, they spray these herbicides that wreck the farm communities, and actually I think that's their goal, so the U.S. agribusiness can dominate the area. But these farmers then flee to the cities, and they can't make it there, and they end up in this country coming across the border. And if you want to compare those herbicides with Agent Orange, you can find that they're real similar. And actually, what you're talking about is those people coming across the border to mess up this country, they have had the same thing happen to them that happened to us. And he says, you know, I never thought of it that way. And, you know, we knew each other real well when we were kids and things. And he was listening. He says, you know, I just never made that connection. That I have something in common with these people. They're fleeing something, and I got stuck in Vietnam. I couldn't get out of there. And that we're victims of the same monster, the same beast. And he did. He recognized that. But we just don't have too much of, you know, you're not going to get that kind of an education in school anymore. I had teachers that were, one of them was in D-Day, Normandy invasion, that when Kennedy got shot, and he was a history teacher, and he told us, he says, if you think Lee Harvey Oswald did that by himself, he says, I got a bridge to sell you.
I think if there's one thing that just about every thinking person in America today, and you know, I mean no insult to people who wish to believe differently, but I think every thinking person today. I mean, I grew up, and one of the assumptions in my world was that Lee Harvey Oswald was the patsy. It's sort of a case of, you know, if you sit down in an outlaw poker game and you don't know who the patsy is, you're the patsy.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, Lee Harvey Oswald, in my opinion, was the patsy. Now, I don't progress, and I know you do in your book, you do an excellent job of exploring a sort of a follow-the-money kind of research there. And it was an absolutely wonderful read. But, you know, I don't progress to know who put it in motion or why. But I will say this, that you know, Lee Harvey Oswald was not, and Jack Ruby, who has a tremendous history. I mean, a lot of people don't know this. He was the guy who got Hank Williams hooked on heroin or whatever it was he was taking. You know, and that's a, you know, just an aside. I mean, and probably a lot of our listeners don't know who Hank Williams was, but he was, in my opinion, a great poet. But, you know, that aside is that, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald was, Jack Ruby was far from the great patriot that he made himself out to be to give himself an excuse for whacking Oswald. No, that was a cover-up. You know, you set the patsy up and you take the patsy down and nobody has to give account for it. And so, you know, I think anybody that that thinks that Oswald actually shot Kennedy is living in a an alternate reality. You know, that was that's. I mean, it's amusing to me that anybody walking around today actually still thinks that. But some do, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, some of them can really put up a good argument that he did that. And you know, I have to say, I'm convinced he was a patsy. I don't think he was anything other than that. And Ruby, you know, just on the face of it, when it happened, it didn't make sense with Ruby shooting Oswald. Here's this guy from South
Chicago. No, it didn't make sense at all.
No, a tough
monster. You know, another aside, and I hate to break in here, but another aside is, you know, and I'm not saying anything one way or the other, but it is an interesting aside, is that the night before Reagan was shot, George Bush, George the First, was having dinner with the shooter's father.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a say what kind of moment, if you will.
Yeah. And I think, and I forget that guy's name.
John Hinckley.
The kid.
John Hinckley Jr.
And I wouldn't doubt for a minute, you know, this is my next book is going to get into this because I'll figure it out one way or another. But I think Hinckley, John Hinckley, might have been in some kind of MK Ultra mind control things. And some of these things, they might not have intended on shooting Bush, but some of these people that have been in these programs, they go off on their own. You know, sometimes they do things that they weren't, somebody didn't necessarily want to program them to do. They turned them into a killer, and they wanted to kill someone, and they killed somebody else. And it wouldn't surprise me if there aren't connections. I definitely found connections with Sirhan and MK Ultra, and
that
and
was
others.
Another case of a patsy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I personally don't think that Sirhan actually shot Bobby Kennedy. He may have, but I just find it. I find it a little hard to swallow. It seems a little too pat for me.
No, I think it's a Manchurian candidate. I mean, there were more bullet holes than there were bullets that he had in his gun. And then the LAPD said they got rid of the evidence because it took up too much room. Now,
when
you got going on, it's illegal to do that.
It isn't just that. If you know bureaucrats, and, you know, I mean, you spent some time in government service, and you know the structure of that kind of job. And if you, of course, you were in the military, but nevertheless, when you're in a certain job, there are certain rules that you go by. And you know as well as I do that no self-respecting evidence technician or cop or anything else is going to dispose of evidence in the biggest case to happen in that jurisdiction since independence. No.
Yeah.
No, it was taking up too much room. Yeah, right. You know, you don't really expect me to swallow that, do you? I mean, that kind of explanation is an insult to the intelligence of any thinking person. If the evidence was disposed of, it was disposed of for a reason.
Yeah,
you know, personally, I quite frankly am not convinced that Hinckley actually shot Reagan.
Yeah, you know, it's hard telling because, you know, my take on it is that we get, we get lied to so much that you can't believe anything these people say. I mean, I wrote
Hello?
Nerve gas, weapons of mass destruction, and all this. And I wrote her about something, and she wrote back to me and says, "Well, I'm on the intelligence committee, so you should trust me. I'm telling you that that the guy in Syria has been using nerve gas and things like that. But I can't tell you the ins and outs of it, but you have to trust me. She didn't put it in those words exactly, but it was,
hey,
it was long enough.
We know.
And here, Feinstein, if she's on the Intelligence Committee, and then every time something blows up, she says, well, I didn't know about that. You know, and either you don't know or you do know, but you can't play I don't know when it's favorable to you. And,
With respect to Feinstein, and I've got to tell you, I'm very disappointed in Feinstein because, you know, she started out as, you know, as a kind of progressive Democrat, and now she's become a part of the establishment. And, you know, it goes back to that old saying, power corrupts. You know, I don't think the Dianne Feinstein we know today is the same Dianne Feinstein who made the speech after Mayor Mascani got killed.
I think she is. I just went into that thing, that whole Jonestown deal, and Feinstein. No, she's a crass opportunist. She always has been. She just says what it is that she needs to say to get elected and stay in office, and she does, and she has been that way.
I will take your word for that. You live in California. I don't. I don't know her up close and personal.
That guy that, and I think it was, what was his name? White.
Yeah.
I think it was
his last name was White. I don't remember what his first name was. I mean, he's kind of a footnote in the history of rock and roll, so to speak.
Yeah, Dan White. Now, she, and this might be inadvertently, you know, I wouldn't say that she knows more about that thing than she's saying, but she supported him financially.
Really?
His businesses. Yeah. And I now,
wow.
You know, don't get me wrong, I'm not making the connection that that she caused that to happen. But there are connections to that. With Mayor Mosconi and Supervisor Harvey Milk, and this sounds out there, but the Jonestown with Reverend Jones, Jim Jones, and all that, there are that was the people he left behind out of that Jonestown thing were the ones that I think were behind that assassination of Mosconi and Milk. And because they knew too much about Jonestown, they knew what Jonestown was really about. And it wasn't anything like what the American people think it was about.
I have heard so many stories about Jonestown that I will put it to you this way. You know, I look at the news, and I'm going to digress for a brief moment here. When I hear the news, the first question I ask myself is, what does the person who put this on the air want me to think?
Mm-hmm.
And then the next question that I ask is, why do they want me to think that? And the incident that really brought that to the fore for me was when the first Gulf War started. And I don't know if you recall this. But the testimony of the girl, the little Kuwaiti girl testifying before a joint session of Congress.
Right,
and she was presented to us. Do what?
She was a princess. It was balling and incubators and babies.
But she wasn't presented to us as a princess. She was presented to us as an average little Kuwaiti girl that managed to escape from the big bad Iraqis. Now, I'm not at all defending Hussein. But I saw that on the news. And the first thing that I said, I was watching it with my ex-father-in-law. And the first thing I said is, this is bullshit. Given the structure of society in those places, there's no way that a working-class Kuwaiti girl made it out of Kuwait City and managed to get to Washington, D.C., and speak before a joint session of Congress. This is a show, and it's a show intended to justify us going to war. And he came totally unglued and said, no, this is the news. It's trustworthy, blah, 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 blah. I said, okay, whatever. Well, it was some years after that that the guy who actually handled that show, which was a public relations consultant who had chaired the Reagan Inaugural Committee, I can't remember his name, but the book is called The Powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, they turned out that the girl was a Kuwaiti princess who was actually on a ski vacation in Switzerland.
Yeah.
When she was flown there to do this show, and because this guy had so many connections, he was able to get her in front of Congress. That makes sense. And so, you know, that's a case of that I was able to study both as it was presented and as, you know, I got to see the guy behind the curtain, to borrow a Wizard of Oz metaphor. And so now when I watch the news, you know, I say to myself, you know, who wants me to think this, and why do they want me to think this? And then I go and I research, and I make my own decision based on what I find behind the curtain. The problem is that the average Joe lunchbox in the country isn't going to take that much time. You know, they don't think that much, and that's the problem. And we've spent probably, 30 years, 20, 30 years or so of not teaching our young people to think. We teach them what to think. We don't teach them how to think.
Exactly, yeah.
And in a sense, this serves the cause of the ruling class, because the ruling class doesn't want thinking subjects. It wants unthinking subjects. You know, it's kind of a return to feudalism, in a sense, sort of a new age feudalism. And we owe it to ourselves and to our posterity to teach your children well as an old rock and roll song. Teach them to think would be the new version of that song.
Well, you know, even further than that, I think that anybody that really does think on their own, you get the FBI after you. And I'll start that with the...
Let me give a nod to the agents that are listening to this conversation.
Well, welcome, guys.
I hope their coffee's hot and their donuts are fresh.
Leonard Peltier, the whole movement there that was, it was 1976 and Pine Ridge. And what these agents were doing, the FBI and others, they were shooting people. They were just killing people for what they said, and what they thought. And that, you know, when we were talking before about other people, well, they did the same thing at Ruby Ridge, and they did the same thing in some other assassination. Waco ended up to be that, and there was one in the book, the Franklin cover-up, where there was this guy that was he refused to pay income taxes because he said the Constitution and all, you know, whether you agree with him or not, he had the right to say that, and if he didn't pay his taxes, then you take him into court. They killed the guy. They came and shot him. They ambushed the guy. And the law enforcement are in there, and it was federal law enforcement, I think it was FBI, that they set up an ambush and killed this guy for saying these things that he had a constitutional right to say. Well, you know, and then you had the Branch Davidians, and you had all this stuff, and then you had these, and mostly, in fact, all of them are, is middle-class white guys arming themselves with these militias and all that. And most of it, you had Timothy McVeigh, and all these types, and, you know, I hate to, types of individuals that think a certain way, that, with the Second Amendment and all this, and take my gun out of my cold, dead hand, and and out practicing shooting all the time, and then you got the FBI going after them. Well, this is something that started with minorities and ended up in the white middle class. And
yeah, this wasn't supposed to happen to us.
Yeah,
that's the attitude.
You've got, I'm telling you, man, some of these younger people, I had these guys that came out, these contractors, and they were all young guys that put in photovoltaic in my house, a solar thing, panels and all that.
Right.
These guys are all like that, that were out here. I mean, that's all they were talking about. And they were talking about all kinds of conspiracies and things like this that are along the lines of, and I think, a legacy from these federal agencies that go in and just kill people. And these guys were serious. I mean, it was the whole crew, and they weren't like they were all buddies or something. This is a whole generation.
No, they were just members of the same demographic.
Yeah, yeah. My son's
age. There was a break point, and I think the I think part of, and I'll refer back to your book, American Heart of Darkness, in the sense that there, when Kennedy got shot, there was a fundamental, almost a psychotic break in the American population, because people born before that, they had a certain faith in the government to a certain extent. I mean, yeah, there was opposition, and there was opposition to policies based on policy issues, but they had a fundamental trust in the institution of the United States, if you will. And after that, people didn't have that faith anymore. It was like there's this sort of underground assumption that the system is corrupt. And so you want your guy in control of it, not because it's good for everybody, because it'd be good for you, because it's assumed that the whole system is morally bankrupt. And the problem with that, even though it may appeal to us if we get our guy in the White House, or we get our guy as chairman of a particular committee or whatever, but the danger of it is it assaults the fabric. There's a fundamental point in traditional Cherokee society, and it's consensus. There are no useless people, and I'm not talking about modern Cherokee life. I'm talking about in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a certain societal fabric, and that fabric was there were no useless people in a Cherokee town. Everybody had a place and a purpose. And decisions were made based on what was good for the whole community rather than what was based on the individual. You could do anything you wanted to do as long as it didn't hurt somebody else, as long as it didn't disgrace your family, and as long as it didn't upset the balance of the community. The problem that we have today in American society is there isn't that. I see a lot of tribalism going on in the sense that this group of people and that group of people and the other group of people, they want something for themselves, and they really don't care about anybody else. And that is dangerous to democracy. It's dangerous to freedom. The biggest danger to liberty is narrow self-interest. That will kill liberty quicker than anything else, second to fear. I want to be safe, and I want it for me. And those are the two main nails in the coffin of liberty. Liberty is messy, liberty is unsafe, and liberty is chaotic. And we have to be prepared to deal with that messiness and that chaos in order to be free. And in our politics today, And I say this on a macro level, both among Native communities and among the society at large, we seem to have forgotten that. We seem to have forgotten that we're not going to get everything we want. But if it's good for the whole, then it's good for me. But instead, we have a society today that what's good for me and screw you.
Yeah. And I'm not
we don't seem to realize that we mortgage our future for today's self-interest when we do that. You know, I want to be free to do what I want, but I don't want you to be free to do what you want. You know, I don't like you, so therefore you shouldn't be free to do what you want to do. You know, and I hear these talk show hosts who present themselves as libertarian, but they're only libertarian when about what they want to do. They're not libertarian about what you want to do.
No. No. Yeah, you know, I find that with, you know, I've got neighbors that are, you know, they'll tell me that they're liberals and progressives. But they're only liberal or progressive for their agenda.
Exactly.
And, you know, and everybody else, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm for gay rights, but I support the death penalty. You know, stuff like this. That if they don't think it really affects them, then those are other people.
Yeah, exactly. As long as you think it won't happen to you, it's okay. And here's my problem. I support the death penalty. Okay, and that's gonna come across as a sort of a slap on the table. But let me put it to you this way: I support the death penalty if it can be justly applied.
Yeah,
my
but
problem,
that's like if my aunt had balls, she'd have been my uncle. You know?
Exactly. Thank you. So, but when, you know, as in the case of, as we discussed some time back about, you know, 55% at one point, 55% of the people on death row in the state of Illinois were factually innocent. Well,
yeah.
If that be the case, then we cannot, we've demonstrated then, if we have 55% of the men on death row in any jurisdiction, okay, that are factually innocent, and I don't mean extenuating circumstances. I don't mean maybe they killed somebody who needed killing. I mean factually innocent, as in they did not commit the crime, then we must abrogate the death penalty because we've demonstrated that we cannot apply it justly. If one innocent man dies, the entire system becomes guilty. Because one of the most holy rules in every philosophical persuasion, whether it be secular ethics or religious ethics or whatever, is that thou shalt not shed innocent blood.
Yep.
So if we have 55% of the men on death row are innocent, then the system is too guilty to be able to justly administer that penalty. Therefore, it must be eliminated.
Yeah, I don't, you know, and I really don't think, we were raised to think that this judicial system wasn't perfect, but almost. But some of the things that I've seen of people and how appeals work, and there are a lot of innocent, just the war on drugs, which is really a war on minorities.
Which is, I will object to that. The war on drugs is a war on liberty.
Yeah.
It is a war on liberty.
Yeah, it definitely is.
It's being used against minorities primarily now, as we discussed earlier, there will come a time when it's going to be used against the middle class, and it is today. It is today.
Yeah.
The Constitution says you have the right you have a right not to be stopped and searched for no reason. Try going down an interstate and get pulled over for speeding on one that's considered by whoever considers to be a drug corridor. And if you're pulled over for speeding and the cop doesn't like your look, you will sit there while he calls out a dog, or you'll give him permission and he will search your car from the front bumper to the spare tire. And that's supposed to be for your own good. Well, to quote Paul Newman in Cool Hand Luke, I wish you'd stop being so good to me, Captain.
Yeah.
You know, the fact of the matter is that it is a war on liberty. And the people who would never accept this as a sort of military checkpoints will accept it because they think it won't affect them. And that's the point. You know, I had a friend of mine one time, and he was a very militant native. He earned his feathers at Wounded Knee. He was at Wounded Knee in 73. And he said, you know, there's a fundamental difference of perception, because he was married to a lady who was Caucasian, and a very good woman. Very good woman. They've been married for, hell, I don't know how long now. And they were driving by, they were driving up the interstate, and they saw this Latino family. Then there was like four cop cars, and, you know, all of their stuff was out on the side of the road, and the cops were going through their house, and the Indian guy says, oh, man, I feel bad for those people. And his wife looks and says, well, if they weren't doing anything wrong, that wouldn't happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about this. This was a private conversation. It wasn't part of a political protest or anything like that. It was a private conversation. And he said, you know, part of the difference between us and them is that when we see these things happen, we know it could happen to us. The problem with the mainstream society is they think it won't happen to them, but one day it will. But then will it be too late? You know, and it's a valid question to ask. You know, if you're a member of a privileged community, and I'm not going to bring race into this because I don't think race necessarily applies to this. But when you know, when you drive by and you see someone being subjected to that kind of force, does your heart go out to them? Do you think of them as people being victimized by the power, or do you think of them as roaches being exterminated by the exterminator? And that fundamental disconnect is what we have to address, because it could happen to you. And that's what we have to realize, not only as members of whatever community, ethnic community we're a member of, but as members of society, we have to remember that it could happen to us. When we allow power to be exercised with impunity, power corrupts. We know this. And when we allow power to be exercised with impunity, and they say, it's for your own good. Well, I wish you'd stop being so good to me, Captain. I don't need you to protect me. I need you to stay out of the way and let me be free.
Yeah. Cool Hand Luke was probably one of the best movies ever made. You know, there was another one, and I think it might have been Easy Rider. No, it wasn't. It was one like that, where there were these redneck types that went and just beat the hell out of these guys that were driving motorcycles. And,
that was Easy Rider.
Was it Easy Rider? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And there was one guy saying something like, you know, why do they, you know, what's wrong with them and all that? And there are some people that, just somebody, they see somebody really free, and it really scares them.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's
the truth. Now, you know, it's kind of like, you know, let's stir the pot a little bit here. If you're gay, let's talk about gay marriage, for example.
Okay.
And what strikes me is funny. Now, as a minister, I will not sanction a gay union, because I think it violates the order of creation. Now, I say that as a follower of a certain theological way, if you will. However,
okay,
I will support their right to do so, and here's why. Because the state does not have the right, under any circumstances, to dictate spirituality. A marriage license issued by the state is simply a contract to pay taxes together. When you think about it, that's really all it is. Okay? So, if a gay couple wishes to pay taxes and go through all of the contractual relationships that a couple owes to the state, which is property taxes, income taxes, so on and so forth, then the state has no right to say that they can't do that, in my opinion. Now, on the other hand, any minister is free to say that his spiritual belief precludes him from sanctioning that union. They're two fundamentally different things. And when we confabulate the church with the state, we mortgage our own liberty. You know, I don't know if you remember the movie A Man for All Seasons.
No, I didn't. I must have missed that one. What you?
It was an absolutely beautiful movie. But in the scene, the main character, he says, you know, because he happens to be in power at that point, and he has an enemy, and he says, and one of his advisors says, you should have the man arrested. And he said, why is that? He's committed no crime. And he said, well, he's an evil man. And he said, well, there's no law against that. And he said, well, make one. And he said, no. He said, well, I would have the devil arrested. And he said, yeah. And for what crime? And what will you do when the devil turns around on you and you have sacrificed every law that protects you? I will accord the devil the protection of the law for my own safety's sake.
Hmm.
When you sacrifice the law, do what?
When did that movie come out?
I don't even remember. It's an old movie. It's called A Man for All Seasons. It was about Thomas Beckett.
Okay. Like when I was in Vietnam, I missed a lot of movies, and I just went back just recently and saw them, and I think Easy Rider was one of them, and there were, you know, some others that we had talked about that I never saw because I was in Vietnam. And I found a lot of those movies to be enlightening, you know. And I wondered if this was one of them that I missed, A Man for All Seasons. That's why I was asking.
It might have been. Like I said, I know it came out in the 70s because, you know, I saw it when I was a kid and I saw it again when I was a young man. And it was a subject of some discussion amongst my intellectual cohort, if you will. You know, that line, which is the only thing I remember about the movie. You know, I'm familiar with Thomas Beckett, but I don't remember anything about the movie other than that line. And that line is, I will accord the devil the protection of law for my own safety's sake. And I see people today, and I'm not picking on any one side here, you know, I see liberals prepared to sacrifice principles that they supposedly hold dear just because they're mad at somebody, and I see conservatives doing the same thing. And my issue with that is, you know, again, I completely subscribe to that philosophy. I will accord the devil the protection of law to protect myself, because, yeah, you know, the sacredness of liberty is permitted to be subject to our current prejudice, then one day prejudice will change, you know, just as fashion changes. And the people who are in power today will find themselves not only powerless, but libertyless tomorrow.
Yeah.
And, in the glory days of empire, imperial powers can get away with a lot because they're expanding. But there reaches a tipping point where imperial societies become stagnant. And that's the point at which they really must protect liberty at all costs. Otherwise, nobody is free, and then you have to go through the whole damn thing over again. You know, it's sort of the French Revolution. You know, if they don't have bread, let them eat cake, which is an apocryphal story. I doubt very seriously that Marie Antoinette actually said that. But it does illustrate the point that, you know, we as members of the human community or human family or whatever have to deal with the fact that while we may call our Creator by different names, or we may not even have a relationship with our Creator, we do have to live together. And as technology and so forth progresses, a lot more of us are going to have to live a lot closer together. And if we don't protect each other's liberty, we won't have it for ourselves. And the war on drugs is fundamentally a war on liberty.
Oh, for sure. It is, and it's one step and a big step toward what I call a prison planet.
The safest place in the world is a Supermax prison.
The only reason that that I characterize as a war on minorities is that in the United States, when you have the defenseless, are generally people that are poor. And disproportionately in the United States, you have minorities that are in that situation. And they're easy to pick
up.
You can put them in jail. They don't shoot back. They don't lawyer back on you. And you can have a public defender that goes in and makes a deal. Whether you're innocent or guilty, it doesn't matter. You know, like we were talking about earlier.
For example, few people know that George W. Bush had a cocaine charge when he was younger.
No, yeah, they definitely don't. And he's been arrested several times. He was drunk driving, get this, he was disorderly at a football game, a Texas football game. Now, to get arrested in Texas at a football game, you've got to be really disorderly. if you tried to do it, Felton, you and I probably couldn't get arrested if we wanted to.
Oh, we probably could. We probably could. But I take your point. I take your point.
He wasn't a kid when he was. I think he was 26 or something like that. He was caught shoplifting. And people say, well, you know, that was in his youth or something, but he was old enough to know better.
The point being, and I'm not saying, you know, he made a mistake, and I'm not saying that he should necessarily have suffered disproportionately for it, but he didn't suffer at all, and the reason being is because he was a scion of the ruling class. And we see this, and the fact of the matter is that, you know, egalitarianism in its purest form only works in a discussion with Voltaire. It doesn't happen in real life. You know, human beings desire a governing structure. One of my favorite quotes of my father, who he passed a couple of years ago, but one of my favorite quotes from him is that government is a necessary evil. It is made evil by its necessity, and it is made necessary by its evil. And that sounded so hopeless, so I pressed him on it, and he said, well, if men loved each other as their Creator commands them, they wouldn't need a government. They would automatically do the right thing. But because men are evil, they need a government. And because government is made up of evil men, the government is evil, so therefore it is necessary. But it is necessary in its evil, and it's made evil by its necessity. So, you know, we have to deal with that. But we must, as thinking people, and I issue a challenge to everybody listening to this, to be the good in the necessary evil. Do what you know is right, because it is right, not because it is profitable, not because it is expedient, because it is right and honorable. And I'm sure we'll get some calls about that.
I wanted to mention, too, we've got about 20 seconds. We can go on for as long as you'd like. We got 26 minutes left. I slotted it for 2 hours, but we don't have to go that long.
Well, do we have anybody calling in?
Not yet. You know, which...
No, that's sad.
Well, it's not really... I'll tell you what. I had Abraham Bolden on that nobody called in on him, but there were 750 people that listened to in the archives. Most of my programs, people don't call in. The ones that do call in... oftentimes don't ask questions. You know, they won't push the one button.
Oh, okay.
But it doesn't mean that nobody's out there. If they don't push the one button to talk, we don't know who's out there. A great many of them, the vast majority of them, listen to it in the archives, in the hundreds. So it's...
Ain't technology wonderful?
Yeah, for whatever reason, I don't... every once in a while, I do get a caller in, and sometimes they'll just want us to, correct something I said, and they're always right. Every time they said, well, you mispronounced this or you did that. Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks for sharing, because at 66 years old, sometimes the wrong word comes out, I'm called Jonestown, Jamestown, and, things like that. But that doesn't mean nobody's out there listening, and they'll listen a lot. And I'd be willing to tell you that probably, Fulton, I would say that in the hundreds are going to hear this.
Love to do it again. We'll take up the 26 minutes we've got left, unless you got somebody else coming on. I have to say I'm thoroughly enjoying our time together, and I always enjoy our time together because it's refreshing to be able to have an intellectual conversation. That isn't bound by the parameters of non-intellectualism, if you will, which is not the right word, but
you and I's phone conversations that we have with each other, except it's figuratively on the air. But, these are the discussions we've had, I
them intellectually refreshing.
Yeah, I do, too. I have found, when I'm doing book launches and book signings and things like that, there are a lot of more people who, some of the subjects that you and I touched on, is that, be careful what you want done to them because it's going to happen to you. There are people picking up on that and aware of that. And especially now, you see a lot more middle-class people who, they're listening if they lost a house. They're listening if they had a kid graduate from college who was in worse shape than
he is. Yeah,
then he would have. He owes $100,000 and he can't get a job. I had a niece that was, and this is a girl, nieces would be, that is working in a pool hall. She's got a bachelor's degree. She's not working in a pool hall now, but when she got out of college, that's the only job she could get, was slinging beer and working in a pool hall. More and more you see this kind of thing where you're better off to have been a plumber, which there's nothing wrong with anyway. Plumbers used to make good money. They don't make the kind of money. They're like truck drivers. They don't make the kind of money they do now.
But they still make better money than some people with PhDs.
Exactly. Yeah. You've got the middle class that has been hollowed out. And financially, the middle class is living in the same homes that they were before. But the middle class, when you and I were kids, those World War II vets, and my dad was pretty typical. He ended up to be a chemical engineer. He never would have gotten a degree if it wasn't for the GI Bill. My first memories were living in a Quonset hut on the University of Minnesota, where he went to school. Well, Uncle Sam paid for that. And, this is American dream kind of stuff.
But it was a different dream then. It was a different dream then. And there's one thing I've noticed, because I remember I talked to my father a lot, and I was homeschooled, okay? So, I'm not a product of the public system. But, my father came back with a chest full of medals and a GI loan and went to college on the GI Bill. And he had this idea, which I found common among his friends, because growing up, I spent more time talking to college professors than I did playing with kids my own age, which, you know, is maybe good or bad, depending on how you look at it. But, you know, it was everybody in my circle growing up, I thought a bachelor's degree was as common as a high school diploma. It wasn't until I was grown and was going to college myself that I discovered that it didn't just happen. Because yeah. I never knew anybody growing up that didn't have a college degree. And
yeah.
But that none of them got their degree so they could make money. They got their degree because they wanted to think. You know, I didn't have, of course, you know, my father was he taught philosophy and literature, so he didn't, you know, there weren't a lot of engineers in our circle, if you will.
Yeah.
But they were all, you know, they all had degrees in philosophy or literature or drama or something like that. And they were all people that, and they liked to do what we do. They would talk. And you know, I would be there, and I was either there or I'd hide under the couch, you know, if my father decided that they were going to have a conversation that wasn't appropriate for me, and he'd tell me to go to bed. And I'd sneak back in and hide under the couch and listen. Learned a lot, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, and they would talk about just ideas, and they would discuss ideas for the sake of discussing ideas. You know, and one guy would have this perspective, and the other guy would have that perspective, and the other guy would have that perspective, and they could disagree civilly. And that was the incredible thing, is because they all considered themselves intellectuals. They were able to present their point without trying to destroy the other person's point. Says, okay, well, I disagree with you on this, and let me say why. And then they'd go in and they'd go into that, and then the other person would come back and say, well, I take your point, but I still defend my original point, and this is why. And they'd go off into a whole other area. And it was a tremendously educational experience just listening to these quite educated, quite bright people discuss ideas that didn't necessarily agree, but it's sort of intellectual weightlifting. They did it for
yeah.
the sake of exercising their minds, and we don't see that, or I don't, at least, these days, see that nearly as much. And maybe I grew up in a rarefied environment, I don't know, but I would pay money to be able to sit down with a group of people from differing perspectives and discuss the differing perspectives within a civil discourse, if you will. And what seems to be missing is civil discourse. You know,
yeah.
if you agree with me, and we agree on everything, life is going to get, the conversation is going to get real boring real quick. You know, we don't exercise our intellect by only surrounding ourselves with people who agree with us. You know, we find ourselves in an echo chamber. And
yeah,
what's
you know,
the point
I,
of that?
You know, I find that, yeah, we grew up, and I used to listen to some of these conversations too, but Dad didn't have two jobs, and Mom wasn't working, and
exactly.
they weren't worried about losing their house, and they didn't have credit card debt at 20, 30. They didn't even have credit cards. They probably had $20,000 to $30,000 in the bank, rather than worried about how they're going to pay their credit cards, and they didn't have. There were no such thing as latchkey kids. And there were, you know, all of these things that have happened. I don't think we have time to think. I don't think we have, and I think we're under so much stress that we don't really just sit there and think. I think our lizard brain is kicking in, our fight or flight syndrome on most Americans, when they're on the edge of collapse.
You are so right. You are so right. And, you know, I go back to my father, and he said, and he predicted this. He said, you know, this is going to change. And I asked him what he meant by that, and he said, well, the ruling class is going to figure out that there are way too many people thinking, and that
mm-hmm.
presents a problem. So what they're going to do is they're going to ratchet up the economic pressure so we don't have time to think anymore.
He's exactly right.
And I thought he was being paranoid. But you know, a lot of my father's predictions, I come to find out, he wasn't nearly as paranoid as I thought he was.
No, when I first came to California, the college education was free. If you were,
I remember those days. I was born in California, by the way.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it was free. I mean, you might have to pay for something. I don't know, but basically, if you had a work study program, you answered some professor's phone or something and got $1.25 an hour for doing that, and did your homework while you were doing it or whatever, or worked off the campus somewhere a little bit. You could put yourself through college. And, you know, it was Thomas Jefferson. You know, I was pretty hard on him in my book. But on his gravestone, it is the thing that he was most proud of was starting the University of Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And that's on his gravestone as his accomplishment, that he was the founder of the University of Virginia. And that's what he was most proud of. And the University of Virginia was free. The people that made this country, they had wars. And the reason I expounded on that is because the warts are not in the history book, and I think they need to be. But
they do need to be.
Said that, Thomas Jefferson, this, and you know, something is really wrong, and what you said about, deliberately, there have been some of the moguls in industry and so forth that were thinking about this and says, no, we can't have this. And especially when you had during the 70s, you had women wanting emancipation and burning bras, you had Native Americans out raising hell, you had blacks raising hell, you had hippies and beatniks and whatever, raising hell, and from these people who are obsessed with order and control, it looked to them like American society was just going nuts.
The world.
They put the law enforcement on us as social control over that kind of thing. That's why the FBI was in shooting people. That's why the Kent State shooting. It was a hallmark Rockefeller undertaking where you had this stray shot that nobody knew where it came from and all that. That's exactly how the Rockefellers put down coal miner strikes and labor organizing and all that. The same thing.
Yep.
They would say,
absolutely.
Well, shot. Pardon?
But the thing about it is, and I hate to interject, but the thing that we have to remember is the golden age of America was the time when everybody was thinking. That was the time when we did great things, and that was the time when we really experienced our golden age as Americans. And I think today that I am unwilling to because of my personal background, maybe we'll get into that sometime. But I'm always unwilling to accept that evil reigns supreme. I fundamentally believe that good and decent people can positively alter the trajectory of space-time, which is a high-flown way of saying that we can all be good, and if we are good, we will alter our circumstance for the better. And, it's like you and I are talking now. And there's the old Chinese proverb, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. You know, this is the first time since I was hiding under the couch with my father that I've enjoyed an intellectual conversation covering such a wide range of issues that wasn't bound up within the narrow parameters of private interest, if you will. In other words, and what I mean by that is, well, this is my issue, and my issue is most important, or that's my perspective, and my perspective is most important. This has been a tremendously refreshing intellectual conversation. And this is a start. You know, perhaps down the road we can bring other people into this, and actually, you know, this could start something.
Yeah,
if that makes any sense.
There are a lot of things.
You know, your book. You know, and I can't find words to tell you how inspiring your book was. Even though the subject matter is so dark and so brooding, it's still inspiring because we can know the truth, and if we know the truth, we can do something about it. Even if we only, you know, even if we only flutter the butterfly's wings one time, it will alter the course of the wind, so to speak.
I think it's going to be crucial, you know, that we understand, and I really appreciate the nice comments about the book, because that's exactly what I was trying to do. I was trying to just show that there is we got where we're at over some good things that have been well documented and over some really bad things that have not been documented too well. And, you know, I was surprised that I didn't have any problem finding, you know, if I wanted to find, what I looked for was books that had been suppressed in this country. Because I said there must be something in there that's dangerous to somebody, or they wouldn't,
exactly.
Nobody would care. And so that's what I went looking for. And that's where I found what I found. It has been documented, but it's just not in our national conscience, so to speak.
Because
nobody's talking
about it, which is what we're doing now. We're altering the paradigm right now.
And I think that there are going to be some hard times ahead. There are environmental problems that we just can't get away from. You cannot do what we're doing. The global environment, the Earth is going to self-correct. And, you know, it's not going to be pretty. But it's going to be,
if I could make a suggestion, you know, if we could do a future program about environmental issues, you know, and I'd love to be a part of it, but I don't have to be. But, you know, we could do a program about that. You know, you have this program, and, you know, we could devote 2 hours to discussing what happened to the Maya. We could discuss what happened to Cahokia. We could discuss what's happened in certain other advanced societies in history and how they got out of balance with their environment and collapsed. You know,
yeah,
and there,
exactly.
there's lessons we could learn from that. You know,
yeah,
it would be an interesting discussion anyway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I have gotten into some environmental issues, but I'd love to do it. I was listening to the sound of my own head roaring when I was doing it, and I didn't have somebody. And I would love to do that with some of those environmental issues with you, because it's, you know, my take on it is that we're kind of like the airline pilot whose engines stop. And once they stop, you got to look for the best place to land. And
Sully and the landing on the Hudson River, for instance.
But I want to go down somewhere where I can survive, or maybe just
Absolutely.
Get buggered up, you know, rather than killed. And I think that's the situation we're in with the global environment. And, you know, it's past the point that we can turn back and refreeze the Arctic and the Antarctic and all these glaciers and all that, and the tundra and all that that is releasing methane, which is many times more greenhouse gas effect that carbon dioxide has. You can't refreeze
the tundra.
Absolutely. We're in that plane, and it's out of gas. And we got to figure out where to land. And, yeah, no, I'm with you on that. I would, in fact, we can do one next week if you'd like to.
Yeah, that works for me. I mean, because I'd like to discuss it from a philosophical standpoint. The problem that I as I see it, we get into with environmentalism is it tends to be politically delineated instead of philosophically delineated. And that's where we get into an issue. I mean, you know, I saw an interesting cartoon the other day, and the guy was making a point from the other side of it, but he did have a point to make, and that was he's got a picture of a guy standing beside his truck that's out of gas, and he's holding a gas can, and he's talking on his cell phone, says, "Hey, man, can you give me a ride to the pipeline protest?" And it sort of illustrates the hypocrisy of the environmental movement to an extent. And I think what we need to address, instead of addressing, you know, it from a political standpoint, we need to address it from a philosophical standpoint. And that is, what are you willing to do? Are you willing to turn your lights off? Are you willing to turn your water off? Are you willing to, you know, for example, wet your toothbrush and then turn the water off till you're ready to rinse your mouth out? Or are you just going to leave the water running and waste it just because you can? And it's a philosophical choice that we make. And if everybody made that philosophical choice, all of a sudden we would use less energy. You know, other hand, you will see people in the middle of the summer have their thermostat at 30 degrees and then go to an environmental protest, and it's like, really? with you.
I was talking to a lady one time, and it was about my book, and somehow we got on the environment and things, and I mentioned a couple of things. She says, "Well, you know, where do you stop with all that? If you're going to do that, okay, you're going to throw your blow dryer away, you're going to do this, and you're going to do that." And I told her, I says, "You don't have to worry about where to stop if you haven't made a decision to start."
Exactly.
And she looked at me. You know, my grandfather used to say, "A cow looking at a new gate." You know, when he and I put up this red gate one time, a brand new gate, and all the cows came over and just stared at it. And he told me to do something later, and I gave him this dumb look, and he says, "You know, you're looking at me just like those cows looking at that gate." And I never forgot that. I've always used that expression that somebody looking at me like it, but she did. She looked at me like those cows looking at that red gate. And
I get that. I understand exactly what you're saying.
But and all of us, you know, it was we just and I wouldn't say we're all that much different, but it's like this sense of powerlessness that prevails throughout the country, that there's nothing I can do. Well, there's nothing you can do if you haven't decided to do anything. You know,
you're only helpless. You're only helpless if you've accepted that you're helpless. You know,
yeah.
Che Guevara was a very sickly child. Now, we all know who Che Guevara was.
Yeah.
And we often don't think of him as someone who suffered from asthma to the point that he almost couldn't breathe half the time.
I didn't know that.
Now, how did Ernesto Guevara, the asthmatic child, become Che, the great revolutionary? It's because he made the choice to do something. Now, whether or not you agree with his philosophy is a whole other issue. And I'm not getting into that, but If you study him as a man, and I have, and understand that how Ernesto became Che, you understand how we can change ourselves. And the question is, you know, if you say somebody should do something, look in the mirror and you will discover you are somebody.
Yeah,
and
we've got one. Just go ahead, but we might get cut off, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm wrapping up. It's just that do one thing. Do one thing every day, even if it's just lift a finger. Just do one thing. Exercise your sovereignty as a created being. And if we all exercise our sovereignty with one step every day, the world will be a better place tomorrow.
I think so. I think that, you know, what we were talking about earlier with power is that we've got to realize that some of the most powerful, I call it metaphysical power, in that, you know, like...
Well, that's the only power that matters.
Yeah, Gandhi didn't have any guns. He didn't have any money. He had a little rag wrapped around him, dirt poor.
He had faith.
That stuff. And here he is, takes on the British Empire and beats him. He had that metaphysical power. And, I think we'll leave it right there, Fulton. And I so much appreciate you being on here. And,
I appreciate your time. I appreciate the work you do.
I love talking with you because you might be a little bit younger than I am, but we came from the same place, you know, with as far as parents and your dad, World War II vet, my dad was too, the GI Bill, you know, all these things. We grew up in the same time, and we know now that something is badly broken. And it's hard sometimes to explain that to young people because they haven't known any different.
Exactly.
And, they think it should be that it's a normal thing. Everybody's under stress. Everybody's running around. And I think this affects us. In a lot of ways, just stress itself it makes you immune, makes you susceptible to disease, mental illness, all these things. Here's this country where we take not only drugs but antidepressants. We're world record holders in taking antidepressants. We can't be having too much fun. And
I think to a great extent, and I'll say this, is that, you know, It is. This conversation is tremendously therapeutic for me because, and I don't mean to sound arrogant in this, is that in so much of my life I feel like I'm surrounded by idiots. You know, people who can think but refuse to. And it is refreshing to exercise the mind in conversation with other people who think, because whether they agree with you or not, at least both of you will come away a little more intelligent. And that in and of itself is a worthwhile exercise of your time.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there are, even though we're under all this stress and we don't have time and all that, there are a lot of people starting to question things. And especially
yeah, absolutely. And I think we may be on the cusp of a new intellectual generation. At least I hope we are. It'd be a lot more fun.
Yeah, Lake Arrowhead is right next to me, and I'm at. And there, you know, these are million-dollar houses and multi-million-dollar houses. The whole community is, and they've always had this kind of snobbish air about them. But a lot of those people have lost their houses. And, I find a lot of them coming to my book presentations and things like this, and they're asking questions. Some of their questions are kind of selfish. He says, I don't want to hear all that. I want to hear about my house. What happened to my house? And I says, well, you know, I'm talking about what happened to your house. But you got to know how it ended up. Before, you know, and you're asking me what direction to go, we got to know where we're at first. Well, sometimes I can get their attention when I start talking about, because they got kids that went to college who can't pay back loans. They lost houses. And when I start talking about those things that they have in common now with a lot of people that are working class people and poor, that they're starting to be concerned about the same issues that that we should have been concerned about all the time, except
yeah,
all
because
the time
all of a sudden those people become my people.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of times when I'm starting out, that's the only way I can get their attention. Is that
I can believe
things,
that.
You know, that we have that we're, if I start to, you know, they ask me about conservative and liberal. First of all, I tell them I don't even know what that means anymore.
Thank you. Because I said the same thing to somebody the other day. I can't tell the difference anymore.
No, and I tell them, you know, my book and what I'm talking about is a lack of integrity. I'm talking about lying. I'm talking about looting the American treasury. I'm talking about thieves, and I'm talking about people that have, that just have no direction other than greed, and they're stealing from us. Now, you tell me whether that's a Republican issue or a Democratic issue.
It's an honor issue. You are going to love my book. You really are.
Yeah, and
I love it.
I would love to write you a review and all that as soon as you get that thing, manuscript or whatever. I'd love to dig into that.
Well, I'm going to have it finished this fall, and you are going to love it because it has, in principle. It has all the things we've talked about, the evil, but ultimately it's optimistic. Good always triumphs, and that's because if it didn't, why read my book? You might as well watch the news. I want you to go away feeling like things are right, because I mean that's the point of fiction, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you want to be depressed, you can watch the news. You don't have to read my book, so to speak. But I've above all things want it to be inspiring. And if it's as inspiring or half as much inspiring as your book was, then it'll be worth good work.
That really makes me feel good because a lot of people will read that my book, and his relatives of mine, it'll say it was extremely disturbing.
It was disturbing, but it was inspiring because you see what the problem is and you know that you can do something. Or maybe that's just my take on it. But if you know what the problem is, then you can do something about it. No, can I fix it? No, I can't. But I can do one thing. And you do one thing. And somebody else does one thing. And 100 years from now, it'll be better.
Yeah. Yeah, we might not even see it in our lifetime, you and I get
that. But it doesn't matter if we see it, as long as we did our part.
Yeah.
As long as we were true to ourselves, as long as we walked with honor and spoke the truth as we saw it, then we've done something useful. And we can walk into eternity confident that we did something useful. We didn't just sit by and bitch, we did something.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think it strikes at what we were talking about earlier with this, I think FDR, although he had his warts too, but
he was
an inspirational kind of guy that was, he empowered the American people. He made them think that they were part of the solution.
A greater whole.
Fireside chats and all that. And you can't take it away from him. He was all for putting all the Japanese in jail during World War II, Japanese Americans and stuff like that. I mean, he had his warts. But,
well, he wasn't Jesus Christ. And that's the thing. I think we expect too much. We discover that somebody's human and then all of a sudden we want to crucify them on the altar of our own self-righteousness. And that, to me, is not only tremendously hypocritical, but intellectually bankrupt. Did you do something useful? And it shouldn't be about, were you perfect? No, we weren't. but we did the best we could with what we had to work with. And
yeah,
the problem
yeah.
with this obsession with perfection and this obsession with self-righteousness is it ends up fostering hypocrisy. And hypocrisy is not a good thing in any term. As you know, I tell people, as a minister, I tell people, I have vices, and I will not espouse a gospel I am not willing to walk. So therefore, I'm not going to tell you that you're sinning from the time you wake up in the morning until the time you go to bed at night. I'm going to tell you to walk with the Creator the best way you know how and to talk to Him every day by whatever name you know Him by.
And
some people
look
at and go,
I have to remember, and I think it was one of these guys, and I'm not sure if it was George Wallace or, I think it was George Wallace, that later on said that, and they asked him, you did this and you did that, and George Wallace says, hey, have you ever been wrong about anything? He says, I was wrong. And I don't know if it was George Wallace or who I can attribute that to, but he was a politician, and he just
got
upset.
I think it was George Wallace. I vaguely remember that, but I wouldn't swear under oath that it was, but I think it was.
Yeah, it was one of them that and I just don't remember, but I remember those words. Have you ever been wrong about something? And he said,
but,
we
had a gathering here. We had a gathering, and we have gatherings according to the old Cherokee liturgical calendar. And I do that more out of a sense of militancy than anything else, is that, I'm honoring a tradition. But in when we have these gatherings, we eat, of course. But there's always a message. There's always a sermon, if you want to call it that. And we talk about, what's real. And I always say, I'm a minister, not a saint. And, I engage in the recreational use of tobacco and I drink alcohol. And I'll tell you that up front, first thing out. And the reason why is because I won't preach my virtue and hide my vice, because I think I owe it to my fellowship to be honest. And I won't espouse a gospel I'm not willing to walk. And so, everybody who comes here knows my vices, and I make sure they do, so that they don't think I'm something I'm not. And I think that is the key. We need to be honest with ourselves. We need to be honest as leaders. We need to be honest as people, in that we're not perfect. We're walking a path. And I published a thing on Facebook the other day. It was a Friday before last. A thought for the weekend: be careful of stones that you throw. It may be your own windows that you break.
And with that, we've got to end here, Walton.
Well, it has been wonderful, and I really appreciate your time, sir.
I'm going to send you a link. First of all, I'm going to find you on Facebook and send you a link to the archives that you can download it if you want from the archives where you have it. And so you're on there as your full. If I put your name in there, I'll find you.
You should. I will put your name in there. So, either you'll find me or I'll find you, and I'm going to add you to the Sovereign Mixed Blood group. I think you'll find it interesting.
Oh, yeah, I sure will. Thank you so much. And with that, this is Fulton Arrington and Bob Kirkconnell, your host. We're signing off for American Heart of Darkness Blog Talk Radio. And thank you, folks, for listening in. And we appreciate that, and I appreciate every single one of the people that spends the time and the effort, because you got to make a positive effort you know, to hear these things and to listen to these things and these ideas and so forth. And we appreciate you. You're true Americans. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, I agree. And thank you. Thank you for your work, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Fulton. And looking forward to seeing you again on here. Bye-bye.
Likewise.